This program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And first today, How the Whole Grain Trend Went Wrong, written by Tricia Pasricha. Refined grains can be a dangerous business. They are digested quickly, flooding the bloodstream with a wave of sugar and stressing the pancreas, the latter of which compensates by producing spikes of insulin. Eventually, those sugar bursts can result in obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. But starting in the 1990s, nutrition experts began offering Americans an enticing deal. You can still eat your bread and pasta as long as you avoid those dangerous refined grains and accept the salvation of whole grains. Dozens of studies showed that whole grain consumption was linked to a lower risk of cancer, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes. By 2015, the Dietary Guidelines for Americans was recommending making whole grains at least half of one's total grain consumption. Grocery stores were soon filled with delicious whole grain snacks, cereals, and shelf-stable breads, each promising a shortcut to health. When Robert F. Kennedy Jr. unveiled his inverted food pyramid this past January, which demoted whole grains to the narrowest tip and elevated animal products, some nutrition experts cried foul, concerned that Americans would abandon a category with decades of science behind it. Nutritionists broadly concur that unrefined foods of all sorts, including oats, vegetables, seeds, and nuts, are a healthier choice than foods that have been heavily processed. At the same time, many researchers suspect that the whole grains on grocery shelves are a fiction. No one can actually agree on what a whole grain food is. And the whole grain products Americans most commonly eat behave in the body much the same as the refined grain foods they were meant to replace. A whole grain, in principle, is a grain, wheat, rice, oats, that retains all three of its original components. Those components are layered a bit like an egg. The bran is the sturdy eggshell, dense in fiber. The starchy endosperm is the biggest part of the grain, akin to the egg white. Buried at the center is the yolk-like germ, rich in vitamins and phytonutrients. Refined grains, such as white flour, have been stripped of their fibrous, nutritious bran and germ, leaving primarily the starch and a bit of protein behind. A whole grain food, the pasta, bread, and breakfast cereals that you actually buy and eat, is a different matter entirely. The 2025 through 2030 Dietary Guidelines for Americans describes a whole grain food simply as one that contains bran, endosperm, and germ. The industry-sponsored Whole Grain Council grants its basic stamp to any product with at least 8 grams of whole grain ingredients in each serving. But it places no restrictions on what might fill the rest of the package. The FDA counts as a whole grain product any food whose grain content is at least 51% whole grain. Walter Willett, a professor of epidemiology and nutrition at Harvard, told me that such definitions are obviously misleading. Several bills have been introduced to Congress that would require food companies to disclose a product's actual whole grain content as a percentage of total grain, but they have all died without a vote. This inconsistency makes studying the health effects of whole grains challenging. A 2022 study applied 5 competing institutional definitions of whole grain foods to dietary data from approximately 40,000 Americans. The authors found that the same person could be a consumer of a high amount of whole grains under one standard and of a low amount under another. They also found that the food category that most commonly qualified as whole grain was ready-to-eat breakfast cereals, which are among the most heavily processed foods in the grocery store. Many of them are high in added sugar and lacking in fiber. Another analysis concluded that foods bearing the Whole Grain Council stamp contain more calories and added sugar on average than products without it. It should be no surprise, then, that when scientists examine whole grains more closely, some claims about their health effects begin to crumble. For instance, a 2022 study Willett co-authored followed more than 200,000 Americans for 25-plus years. The team found that foods such as brown rice and oatmeal reduce the risk of coronary heart disease, but that popcorn, technically a whole grain under any definition, does not. And in a small randomized trial from 2009, whole wheat bread produced a higher blood sugar spike than white pasta did, despite the fact that the bread contained five times as much fiber as the pasta. In other words, a refined grain product clearly outperformed a whole grain product on the very metric on which the whole grains were supposed to win. It's still not clear what is driving these inconsistencies. But some researchers have an idea. Perhaps instead of the presence of bran and germ, what matters is the physical architecture of the grain itself, including how tightly its molecules are packed together. Most commercial whole grain breads and cereals are molecularly disassembled. Darush Mazafarian, a cardiologist and a nutrition researcher at Tufts University, told me, "Bran, endosperm, and germ may be sourced from different factories, then recombined into a new food product. Compared with intact grains, such as brown rice and corn kernels from the cob, molecularly disassembled whole grains are digested more quickly and, just like refined grains, spike your blood sugar faster and leave you hungrier sooner, which may contribute to metabolic disease over time. Even if the grain's components aren't sourced separately, structure seems to matter. In one small 2022 study, a team of researchers matched whole grain and refined wheat products for every possible physical property. They ground them into the same particle size, prepared them in the same food form, in this case porridge, and sourced all samples from the same batch of wheat at the same mill. Participants ate the matched products, and researchers measured blood sugar response. The whole grain advantage vanished. An earlier study from the University of Otago in New Zealand had a small group of adults with type 2 diabetes eat a variety of 100% whole grain foods that differed only in milling method. After 2 weeks, the participants who were eating less processed whole grains had lost about a pound of body weight, while those eating finely milled equivalents gained about the same amount. And even for products that have been finely milled, the final structure of the product seems to matter, because denser foods resist rapid digestion. Bread and pasta, for example, are both made from flour, but only pasta is extruded under pressure, compacting the starch into a dense matrix that digestive enzymes access slowly. Disrupting the structure of a whole grain may also change how it affects the microbiome. When a grain is highly processed, its starch gets rapidly broken down in the small intestine, spiking your blood sugar but never reaching the colon, where most gut bacteria live. In a less processed grain, some of that starch travels further, arriving to the colon intact, Mosafarian explained. In theory, the colon microbiome then feeds on that starch to produce hundreds of beneficial compounds that have positive effects on other organs. Plus, during processing, Many commercial whole grain breads have their natural insoluble fibers extracted and replaced with a soluble fiber, such as inulin. Bruce Hamaker, a professor of food science at Purdue University, told me. Soluble fibers can improve the texture of the bread and help it retain moisture to keep it fresher longer. But that comes at a cost. Those natural fibers selectively nourish a group of gut bacteria that help reduce inflammation and reinforce the intestinal barrier. Without a label to indicate whether a grain structure has been disrupted before it goes into your food, choosing the healthiest grains can be difficult. Mosafarian recommends looking for products that can contain no more than 10 times as many grams of carbohydrate as grams of fiber, a rough proxy for structural and fiber integrity. He also recommends a rubric that requires no math. Imagine putting the product into a cup of water and coming back 4 hours later, he said. If it's a mush, it tells you it's going to be rapidly digested. If it looks mostly the same, it probably has some natural, intact structure. None of this means that people should abandon whole grains in favor of meat and whole milk. What it suggests, rather, is that the benefits scientists have been measuring may be only a fraction of what minimally processed whole grains can actually do. Today's second story, The Literary Job AI Can't Replace, written by Rebecca Ackerman. Nothing seems to make literary-minded people angrier than an author taking credit for writing they didn't do. A few weeks ago, Hachette canceled the U.S. release of a novel titled Shy Girl, following a barrage of online accusations that it had been written with the unacknowledged help of AI. Last month, authors and journalists posted furiously about Grammarly's claim to offer large language model-based coaching from versions of living and deceased writers, without their participation, compensation, or even consent. The company behind the app ultimately pulled the feature. The collective outrage overlooks a fact that the publishing industry acknowledged long before the rise of artificial intelligence. Not everyone with a great idea or unique story has the skill, experience, or time to write a book, or even a book review. Right now, AI tools are cheap and widespread, ready to tap in with a service that some people do need. But these models have been trained on uncompressed creative labor. Uncompensated creative labor. They plagiarize. They lie, and they lie about lying. So instead, I'd like to make the case for a frequently maligned profession, one I've participated in, that rewards good writing, helps authors survive in an ever more challenging field, and allows remarkable perspectives to reach an audience they otherwise wouldn't. That's right. Ghostwriting is good, actually, when it's done by humans. Ghostwriting has an undeservedly bad reputation. Even without AI, some readers feel betrayed if the name on a book's cover doesn't tell the whole story. When the actress Millie Bobby Brown put out a novel based on her grandmother's life with the help of a ghostwriter, people on X told her she should be ashamed. The sense of stolen valor isn't new. 30 years ago, Hillary Clinton allegedly worked with a ghostwriter for her 1996 memoir, It Takes a Village, a move not uncommon for political figures. But the stigma was apparently so great that Clinton didn't acknowledge her collaborators' contributions to the book at all. That said, the stigma has been fading. California Governor Gavin Newsom worked with a ghostwriter for his memoir, published in February. Many other public figures recognize the value of the profession and credit their ghostwriters in print. Demi Moore thanked her as the New York journalist Ariel Levy at the start of the acknowledgments in her 2019 book, Inside Out. The cover of the 2020 memoir, The Meaning of Mariah Carey, credits both the singer and the Vibe and Essence editor, Michaela Angela Davis. Clearly, that collaboration paid off. The book hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Carey's memoir is a favorite of Claire Parker and Ashley Hamilton, who for 5 years hosted a podcast, Celebrity Memoir Book Club, for which they read more than 250 books. Not only do they have no problem with ghostwriting as readers or fans, they might prefer it. They thought Alec Baldwin's 2017 book, Nevertheless, which he wrote himself, was preposterous. The pair also found Shania Twain's self-written memoir tough to get through, despite gripping real-life drama. A narrow escape from a violent parent, her husband's affair with her best friend. Why would someone who rose to the top of their field in singing or acting also be incredibly capable with long-form narrative storytelling, Hamilton told me. It's really hard to do, and people spend years and years studying it. Even autobiographies written entirely by their subjects have been edited, of course. No doubt some have been heavily edited. The lines between that work, ghostwriting, and co-authoring can be blurry. An author could come to a ghost with a full draft, or a co-author could start from a blank page. Because of this fuzziness, the ghosts I spoke with, only gave estimates of the number of books they've written, depending on how you'd count certain projects. What seems clear to me is that experts should hire experts, and everyone should get paid. When would-be writers use AI, tech companies and their investors profit. Ghostwriting, however, offers experienced writers a real living in an industry where a sustainable career often looks like a long-lost dream. According to a 2024 survey administered jointly by the Gotham Ghostwriters Agency and the American Society of Journalists and Authors, 1 in 3 ghostwriters makes more than $100,000 in annual income from the work. Compare that with the median gross book-related income for authors published by the Big Five houses in 2022, about $15,000, according to an Authors Guild survey. Those numbers are stark, but of course fees vary per project. Julia Shires, who teaches memoir writing at Stanford's Extension Program and wrote her own best-selling memoir, tells me she charges an hourly rate of $150 for ghostwriting engagements that can last months or years. Caroline Kalla, a writer based in New York who has ghostwritten about 10 books for actors, athletes, and business people, told me she's had deals that touched the six-figure range. Many of these projects arrive pre-sold to publishers, with the contract and timeline already worked out. Kalla, who has written a series of middle-grade books under her own name, says that even when the rates are comparable to those for a personal project, ghostwriting feels like less of a gamble because the work isn't being done in hopes that an imprint will buy the book later. Corey Powell, who frequently collaborates with the science educator Bill Nye, appreciates that he can set his rate up front based on the math of his own time and effort. And when the client is in tech, entertainment, or business, ghostwriters can try to tap into much deeper pools of money than those available in traditional publishing, and then use that cushion to fund their own work. Ghostwriting may be threatened by large language models, but these tools offer only a shadow of the service a real-life writer and editor can provide. The ghostwriters I talked with feel that the best work always happens in a very close collaboration with the named author, in an atmosphere of mutual respect for what each person brings to the table. The collaborator's skill with tone and narrative, the author's fluency in their own life and expertise. A good collaborator can also be a thoughtful sounding board and trusted advisor. Every client that I have ever worked with on a ghostwriting project has said, "This is amazing. It feels a lot like therapy," Calla said. I think that the human experience of sharing your stories and secrets with someone, whether they make it to the finished product or not, is something that cannot be replicated. That intimacy is not just a pleasant side effect, it produces great prose. Caitlin Alario, a poet who's worked on about 20 ghostwriting projects, recently lost a client to AI after 5 years of working with them on a memoir. The client was frustrated about the process and running out of money to pay Alario. But when she showed Alario the results of her experimentation with AI, Alario saw that the tool had completely distorted the client's voice, at times even inserting a cruel tone where the author had meant to sound funny. "I've never heard you talk about people this way," Alario told her. Shiri's also had a client try to use AI to make edits, but she reminded him that, at least for now, most traditional publishers won't buy a book that's been touched by the technology. As with most things, you get what you pay for. When done well, ghostwriting can be a generative and respectful path to a sustainable livelihood for writers. And for anyone without literary talent or training, employing a guide, coach, therapist, and sparring partner, in other words, a human ghostwriter, will pay off in the form of a better book, which usually sells more copies. In a world drowning in AI slop and hot takes, careful craft matters. So please don't just ask ChatGPT. Hire a professional. Next, Iran could be America's next Vietnam. Written by Graham Wood. The prediction that Iran will be America's next Vietnam, a moral catastrophe, an abyss into which money and lives have been pitched, with the sole effect of weakening the United States and heartening its enemies, is already in general circulation among Americans. A few days ago, the Iranian embassy in Hanoi joined the doomsaying. Its X account featured an AI-generated image of an American GI being lectured to by a smiling Vietnamese soldier in Saigon on April 30, 1975. "We thought that after the Vietnam War, you would never invade any country again," the soldier says. "It seems that after 50 years, you have forgotten that devastating defeat." 50 years before 1975 was 1925. Why not show present-day Vietnam? Probably because it would be a nightmarish scene, not for an American, but for a Vietnamese communist, or for that matter, for a present-day Iranian hardliner. Modern Saigon is the site of a total victory for market economics, global trade, and consumer culture. American products compete without stigma. You can get a Vietnamese-style coffee at Starbucks. In 2023, Vietnam entered into a comprehensive strategic partnership with the United States, an official diplomatic designation for the highest level of cooperation. Vietnam is not a democracy, and its government would happily forget Western notions of human rights and civil liberties, but it does not hate America. Which is why, to invoke the Vietnam parallel, Iran has to pretend that the past 50 years went rather differently. At this point, Iran as America's next Vietnam sounds less like a curse than a relatively optimistic scenario for all involved. Here is the course of events. 1. The United States attacks and escalates when an adversary refuses to surrender. 2. The United States grows stymied and confused that this adversary persists, despite devastation. 3. The United States leaves in a huff and in denial about having lost the war. 4. The attacked country celebrates its heroic resistance, but soon realizes that it has been reduced to rubble. I asked Vietnam experts how a country spoiled for reasons to hate America eventually came to have such fondness for it, and whether Iran, now in a self-congratulatory phase, might have anything in common with Vietnam after their respective wars. K.W. Taylor, a historian at Cornell, told me that at least one aspect of the post-war situations already matches. In Vietnam, Taylor said, you had a very autocratic, authoritarian regime, and that aspect of it just strengthened as a result of the war. Iran, according to most analysis, is more tightly controlled by authoritarian hardliners than it was before the war. After the fall of Saigon, normalization with the United States took 20 years. That is long enough for a generation to pass. Vietnam had the support of China and the Soviet Union during the war. Carlisle Thayer, a Vietnam specialist at the University of New South Wales, told me, but that fell away, and by the time the Soviet Union collapsed, there wasn't much left. The economic modernization of Vietnam paralleled Mikhail Gorbachev's reforms of the late 1980s and reflected a consensus that the alternative to growth through reform was poverty through stagnation. Thayer ventured that Iran might already face isolation of the sort that forced change on Vietnam. Vietnam had the support of global communism. Iran, by contrast, does not have a world Shiite community supporting it. Iran is not a minor planet in the galaxy of Shiism. It is the sun, and when it goes dark, no other will exist to reignite it. The multiple whammies that affected Iran even before this war, economic catastrophe, ecological collapse, diplomatic isolation, social unrest, had already brought it to a nadir. All of this presumes that Iran's leaders have a hitherto latent pragmatic streak. None of the despair so far has led Iran's leaders to compromise at all, either with the United States or with its own people. And attempts to help the Islamic Republic evolve into a normal country through negotiation have made fools of the proponents of that dialogue. What might prevent Iran from making a Vietnamese-style exit from its pit is if the exact opposite is the case here, and if revolutionary Shiite Islamism is the end and everything else is the means. Being unwilling to take the W, like North Vietnam, and move on is a course of self-destruction that Iran is unfortunately still capable of following. That last article had to be edited for time, and we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please join us next time. We hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.